ॐ भद्रं करले विश्वनुयामते वाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षतिर्यचत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्ट्वागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तार्क्ष्यो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः
Okay, we're in verse 8. What page are you on?
168.
Okay.
Nachakshusha grihyate napi vacha Nanyar devais tapasa karmana va Nanyar devais tapasa karmana va Jnana prasadena vishuddha sattvas tatastu Jnana prasadena vishuddha sattvas tatastu Tam pashyate nishkalam jayamanaha.
That nishkalam is one word. You have to draw a line across. Do you see where there's a break in the Sanskrit? Draw a line there, but it should be nishkalam.
It's
a typo.
That's funny.
Yeah. Na chakshusha grihyate Na api vacha na anyaihi devaihi tapasa karmana va jnana prasadena vishuddha sattvaha tataha tu tam pashyate nishkalam jayamanaha. This verse, the previous verse was dealing with, previous couple of verses were dealing with secondary sadhanas for gaining this knowledge. It has to do with antakarana shuddhi. So there are all of these verses about satyam, speaking the truth, and all of the things, all of the values and all of the things that we practice in order to dharma, practicing speaking truth, practicing ahimsa, non-injury. So all of the values that we've learned, even practice different types of practice of meditation and pranayama, all of these type of things that are used to bring about a degree of antakarana shuddhi, peace of mind. So they're called they're secondary values, right? Because they're also called upayanishta. They're things that are used to bring about a shanti, a peacefulness in the mind. So that mind then can be available to gain this knowledge. So then the upayanishta, what is the particular means, the particular sadhana, you know, that is meant for freeing you, for gaining liberation. And so that sadhana now is being talked about in this verse. What is what they call the asadharana sadhana, that which is directly, immediately related to liberation, to moksha. One example, I think it's either in Aparoksha Vibhuti or at the beginning of Atmabodha, now that we just finished in our class, I can't remember back that far. There's one example that they use in terms of what is the immediate means and the secondary or the auxiliary means for gaining, you know, for liberation. They use the example of cooking, heating something on the fire. Say if you want to boil water, you want to heat water, So you can have some tea. So you can have some chai. We're going to heat some water. Right? Well, there's a lot of auxiliary means, like, for instance, the pot that has to contain the water. And then you have to go fetch the water. You've got to fetch the water, put it in a pot, put the pot on the stove, light the fire, all kinds of things that you have to do, right, to prepare for the heating of the water, which occurs through the fire. Right? The fire is what is necessary. You can get the pot, right? You can get the pot, you can fetch the water, you can have the stove, you can have all of these secondary means. All of them are necessary. They're all a support. But unless you bring the fire in, the water doesn't get heated. And so here, say you practice dharma, you know, and practice dharma means that you live a life of values, ahimsa, non-injury. You have a meditative life, you know. You practice pranayama. You do everything perfectly, you know. Living a moral life, a moral spirit, a religious life. Well, that moral religious life itself give you moksha. We say no. Those are secondary. It's very, very helpful. It's very helpful because it gives you the mind that has enough shanti, enough peace to be able to then allow you to gain knowledge. But what is necessary for moksha, for liberation, is knowledge, right? And so no matter how much you practice, how much dharma you practice, or how long you meditate, say you have a meditative practice, you sit there for 10 hours a day, you know, with all of your breathing and pranayama and yoga, and you sit there staunchly 10 hours a day, year after year, after year after year after year, and what do you have? Well, you have 10 hours a day of sitting, 10 years worth of sitting there year after year, generating perhaps many experiences, many blissful experiences. You may also have lived a very dharmic life, and so enjoy the rewards of that dharma. Enjoy the whatever rewards of a meditative practice brings you in terms of shanti or peace of mind. But now say you stop your practice. Then the peace of mind that is generated by that practice comes to an end. It's just like, believe me, this is the truth. If you diet, as long as you are doing this practice religiously, you religiously practice this day after day after day after day, you will lose weight. But you must religiously practice it. Now say, you religiously practice it, and then you say, all right, I'm going to go on maintenance. So now you're not religiously practicing losing the weight, but you want to practice maintaining the weight that you are at. Okay? Now we've adjusted. All we've done here is adjust the practice. And now to maintain the weight, I am now having a new practice. Now, what if I were to give up this new practice, the maintenance practice? Well, it depends on which way I give it up. If I give up the maintenance practice to not eat at all, then I'll go back to the losing weight. If I give up the maintenance practice by deciding, heck with it, I think I'll just eat whatever I want, right? Then I'll go this way. So what I'm saying is, I mean, I think dieting is a wonderful example because we're all plagued by it. Everybody knows what it is. Everybody knows what weight watching is. We're all plagued by it. We all understand maintenance. We all understand what's involved. We all understand that you have to keep doing it in order to maintain the given effect of it. It's the same. With anything in samsara, it's the same as that. We have to keep doing it in order to maintain it. So when we talk about moksha, we can't be talking about doing, right? If we're talking about liberation, we're not talking any longer about doing or about maintaining. What it boils down to, and I'm just going to do a little quickie here because I don't want to go too much in this direction. But what it gets down to is either as a jiva, as an individual, you are a limited being subject to change. You are a finite, limited being. If that's your reality, then you are on a maintenance program. Your moksha doesn't exist. Moksha doesn't exist the way we define it. What exists is what you already know as a samsari. You have to eat well, you have to exercise, you have to follow dharma, you have to do this and you have to do that and you have to do this and you have to do that in order to try to maintain some semblance of well-being in your life. But it is a maintenance program. And so your liberation then means that you're a religious maintenance man or woman. One guy used that. I don't know if any of you remember Mark. He used to sit right over here. Mm-hmm. Remember him? Yeah. He used to talk about being a religious maintenance man. That's what he realized, you know, because he was living kind of a religious life within an organization. And that's what the life had come down to, is just simply maintenance. But if it's not going to be maintenance, then the fact is you already are what you seek, that you already are fine, and there is nothing to maintain. The swarupa, the very nature of your being as you are, is already perfect. There's nothing for you to do, there's nothing you can do. You are what you are. If that reality, that's the reality, if the reality is, we could say like this, if the reality is that your being, you are the changeless whole, right? That you are what you seek, and what you seek is not something that can, and that the being that you are is not something that can come into being or go out of being or be subject to change. If that's the reality, then what's your problem? Say if you are what you seek, then what's the problem? Because if you already are that, then why are you seeking? See, I mean, if you already are that, then why are you seeking? Well, there's only one reason. If you already are that, and you're still having trouble, the problem is that you're ignorant of it. You are what you seek, and you don't know you're what you seek. Right? And that's the only way it can be, if there is such a thing as freedom. Otherwise, if you're not what you seek, then there's something that you have to do. If there's something that you have to do, you have to become something. If you have to become something, then you exist. You are existing within time and space. If you are existing within time and space, then becoming is endless. Right? Becoming is endless. You can't stop. You can't get off the train of becoming, because there's nothing in this creation that is not continually changing, and there's nothing about you that is not continually changing. And you try to stop the change. All we can do is hang on for the ride and try to direct the change into a way that we think might work the best for us. But you can't get off the train of change. Right? You can't get off the train of birth and death. That's what change is. It's birth and death. Right? And so if that's the situation, then you just learn how to live a dharmic life. That's about the best you can do. And in fact, the whole first part of the Vedas is about that, how to live a dharmic life. How to have some rituals. If there's something you really, really want and you can't figure out a way to do it, you can do these rituals in this particular tapas. And then maybe the creation will bless you. You'll get some extra blessings from the creation to fulfill that desire. But it tells you basically what you really have to do. Even that won't make you happy. The best you can do is fulfill those desires, all right, but live a dharmic life so that you can have the shanti that comes along from with that. And that we learn just as jivas. Going along, we learn that, you know, that doing to others, that sadharana dharma, that general dharma that's true to all beings, doing to others as you would have done to yourself. And we go on, we don't have to be really told that. almost inborn. We go on learning that and learning it and learning it and learning it and learning that that's what we can do to have the most peace. But even with that type of peace, it's still relative. We're still bound by change and bound by change and bound by change, and there's no escape from that. And so say, if that's the case, then in the Vedas, all they would have available then, or need, is the first part of the Vedas, because in this situation, this is the best you can do. Follow Dharma, fulfill your desires as you can, but have your primary emphasis be on Dharma, because that'll give you the highest amount of shanti that you can get in this creation. But in the Vedanta, in this tradition, there's more than just the first part of the Vedas. There's the Vedanta. And the Vedanta is for the person who says, is there something about me? Is there something about me that is real, that is free, that isn't on this train of change? And what is that? Every Upanishad is meant to reveal that. What that is, the answer is yes, there is something about you which is real, which is free, that is not subject to change, that is the whole, that is the immutable being, the immutable presence, that conscious being that you are, that is that immutable presence that is the self of all experience. That's the Upanishads have this vision to unfold for you. How do they unfold it? Right? How is it unfolded? Again, it has to be, the Upanishads have to have a vision to make you see who you are. That's what it says. This vision is tatvamasi, you are that. The vision of the Upanishad is you are that, you are the whole. How can you recognize I am the whole? Okay. So this is how it is starting to tell you this. Tells it to you in the negative. Nechakshusha grihyate. This, talking about the Atma, which is Brahman, the Self. This is not something that you can perceive through your eyes. You can't perceive yourself through your eyes. You can't look at yourself. Why? Because, think of it in terms of the imagination and you being identified with a character in the imagination. And you are trying to understand the truth of that imagination through your eyes. You see the problem? If you're trying to understand the truth of the imagination through your eyes, you can't. All you can do is experience what's going on within the imagination. And that dream character in that daydream that we worked on in the meditation, that dream character needs to recognize, I am the whole of the imagination. I am the self, the one from whom the imagination has come. Like here, for the vision of the Upanishads, I have to recognize myself as an individual, that this conscious being that I am is the self of the whole. I have to be able to recognize that I, this me here, I am all of this. I am this whole. Can I see that with my eyes? No, because with my eyes I can only see forms within the whole. How can I recognize that my being, this conscious being that I am, is the whole, not through my eyes? Then he says, napi vacha, nor also through speech. In other words, nor also through words. Here they're talking about the vacharta, the immediate meaning of the words. What if I say to you, like I can say in reference to an object, I can say, this is a cup. Right? This is a cup. Cup is the immediate meaning of this word. And so a cup lends itself to a word, right? This is a lamp. This is an object within the creation. It lends itself to speech. I can label it with a word. This is a chair. This is a body. These are eyes. These are ears. I have words that can label. This is space. This is the passage of time. This is change. We can mark change. We have words for everything that exists within the creation. on a physical and subtle level, I can say, oh, I'm watching the thoughts go by in my mind, or my mind is agitated, or my mind is happy, or I am having a daydream and this is what I dreamed. I can say, the dream is more subtle than the physical world. I have words. Words are the words that I have can describe this creation. But now what about myself, the conscious being? Do I have a word for that, for me? Well, let's try. Say if I say the word me, for instance. What is the immediate meaning of the word me? M-E, me. Well, if I'm using it, if I say this is the me here, who am I talking about? This body, mind, sense organs, person. But if I say you, well, I'm talking about you, or you, or you. Or they, or it. Right? What if I say, take a more abstract word, like existence? What does the word existence mean? What if I say to you now, thinking we're thinking Vacharta, say you don't know anything, you're just a normal person, no Vedanta, and I look at you in all seriousness, I say, you are existence. Well, what can you do with that? You just want to run. You just want to run away, you know? What if I say, let me show you some existence? No. But we have the word existence. We have this word existence, but what do we do with the word? What do we mean by the word when we say existence? Well, we mean the thing has existence. The thing has existence. What does that mean? Well, here's a lamp. It has existence. Means the lamp is. But I can't divorce existence from the lamp. If I say this lamp has existence, it means the lamp is. Right? So all we really mean is lamp. Right? The lamp has existence. No, the lamp is lamp. That's what it means. Everybody see that? Space exists. The space has existence, means the space is, means space is here. There is no existence that I can show you as an object. What about consciousness? Here's another word. We have the word consciousness. Can I say, look at the consciousness? I can say, I am a conscious person. That has a lot of different meanings. It has a lot of secondary meanings. I am a conscious person. You know, means I'm hip, I know what's going on, I'm a conscious person. Or I could say, I am conscious as opposed to being the table being inert. I am conscious, this is inert. But I'm still, these words are only being, we can only use these words to map out our experience. The word existence, consciousness, happiness, bliss, joy, all of these words, we have all of these words, but all of these words are used to map out our experience within duality, right? So now, look, what word am I going to use to say, I am the whole? In terms of the immediate meaning of the word, let's say you don't know anything, and I just look at you in all seriousness, and I say, I am the whole. Or I say, you are the whole. If I look at you and I say, you are this creation. You are the creation. What if I say you are infinite? What if I say you are infinite consciousness? What if I say all that there is infinite consciousness? All of this is only infinite consciousness. And you're using the immediate meaning of these words. What I'm saying is that nothing happens. Nothing happens to the mind at all. Because these words, like this is a cup, these words, whatever they may be, land upon our map of the world. And what is our map of the world? Well, it's whatever I experience as a jiva within the world. Right? And all of those experiences are bound by change, by time and by space and by change. And so therefore, all the language that I have available to me, right, is not going to label myself. It will label my body, it'll label my sense organs, it'll label my mind, it'll even label my I thought, I am doing this, I am doing that, my moods and my emotions, right? And it will label all of the experience, sensory experiences I have and emotional experiences I have. That's what words will do. But how will they label me, the one who is non-objectifiable, the conscious being for whom all of these experiences are? So here we don't have any words. We don't have any words available to us. The Upanishads have words. The teaching tradition of Advaita Vedanta has words, because it's not that they have words, they handle the words that you have. They handle the words that we have as individuals, right? Our language. They handle our language in order to break through the language, to break through the immediate meaning of the words, so that we can recognize what those words, once broken through, are pointing to. So these words that, if used in their own accord, simply point out the nature of the world, the nature of our experiences. If they're handled properly, they can imply something else, give a secondary meaning, if they're handled. But what we have available to us as an individual are these primary meaning of the word. So he says, this Atma, the self, it can not something that can be seen, because it's not a form. It's not something that can be described through words, because it's not an object, right? It doesn't lend itself to what we call the vachyarta, the immediate meaning of the words. And he says, na anyahi devahi, and not by any of the other sense organs either. Anyahi, others, na anyahi devahi. Deva is used for indriyas, those which are luminous. So none of the other sense organs either, like your ears, or your sense of touch, or your sense of smell, or your sense of taste. All of the sense organs only give you knowledge of what's going on in the creation. So they're not going to give you knowledge of yourself as the whole. In fact, they'll give you a knowledge of everything that you're not. Right? Everything that you're not, in the sense that you're through sense perception, you divide up the world. Like, I see you and I see me. Right? And you and you and you. And me, and actually I see me, but I see my right leg and my left leg. Right? I see my right hand and my left hand, and I see my five fingers, and then I see my nails. Where are you going to stop? Where does it stop? Right? It's just an infinity of differentiation. If you were to pursue what you see, pursue what you hear, you know, I mean, follow the track of what you see. Follow the track of what you hear, of what you touch. What you find is something that's infinitely divisible. You'll never get to the end of it. Just start looking at your own body. You start seeing this as a whole, right? But then if you look a little bit more carefully, well, it's not a whole. It's a whole, but it's a whole composed of, you know, two legs and two arms and and a torso. And then, of course, there's the feet and the toes. And then, of course, there's the hands with the fingers and the nails. Where are you going to stop? Where are you going to stop in the differentiation? That's what our sense organs can give us. They can give us knowledge of this universe that is endlessly divisible. And then we can name every single one of those things we discover. Right? That's the vacha. We perceive it through our sense organs, and there's no end to the complexity with which we can perceive this creation, and then we can name it. But what about the being, the conscious being, for whom all of this perception is? That we're not going to get anywhere by doing that. So not by any of the other sense organs either. Then he says, And not only that, so you're not going to be able to gain it through these means of knowledge, but also natapasa. He says, not by tapas. In the Vedic tradition, tapas means austerities. You know? It's single-pointed pursuit of, in order to gain something. It can be on a spiritual level, on a meditative level, on a practical level, by the single-pointed pursuit, by right appropriate effort, and by austerities, by discipline, I can gain anything that I set my mind to gain. If I take the right action and do the right austerities through tapas, I should be able to gain that. Here, you can't gain it by tapas. What you should be able, when tapas, they use tapas because with tapas you should be able, if it's really difficult, if the tapas is correct, you should be able to get it. You should be able to do that. Here you can't gain the Atman by tapas. Why? Because you're already there. You're already here. We're talking about the one who's doing the tapas. The one who's doing the tapas is already gained. And so no amount of tapas is going to take you there. No amount of tapas is going to result in your own being. Because you're the one who's doing the tapas. See the problem? So no amount of tapas will get you there. Then he says, karma na va. No amount of karma. Here karma means ritual. You should be able to do, if tapas won't get there, you should be able to do a ritual, a mahayagna. You should be able to do a ritual in order to bring in all of the gods to help you, to evoke all of the powers, to be able to manifest that for you. So here he says, it's not by tapas, karmana, not by ritual either. There's no amount of ritual that can give it to you. Why? Well, it's for exactly the same reason. Yourself is already present. Yourself is already present. What can you do to gain it? What austerities need you do? This is actually very, very important because some of this stuff has come down to us, right, in the West. If I could only do enough austerities, you know. They have it in India also, very strict, very, very strict austerities. You know, those could have some beneficial result as long as you know what you're doing. If you believe that the austerity is going to produce the result, that the austerity is going to produce moksha, is going to produce liberation, that's where the problem comes in. If you think the action or the karma is going to produce liberation, is going to give you yourself, that's the problem. If you do an austerity or you do a discipline in order for antakarana shuddhi so you can gain knowledge, that's fine. But then you know what you're doing. What if you don't know what you're doing? You know, then you're standing on one leg, you know, with your hand up in the air with no clothes on, you know, until your whole skin turns into bark and you can't... I've seen this.
Yeah.
And you can't... You've done it for so long that your arm is frozen. You've got frozen shoulder. So it's not going to come down again. Okay? This is the austerity. So maybe Bhagawan will look kindly upon you and think, oh my God. Let's let this person die and get him a good birth.
Punya.
Try again. Try again. Try again. Yeah. It'll result in the austerity, you know. It'll give you the result of the austerity, but the result of the austerity is not yourself. Yourself is already there. If the self is already there, no amount of austerity or karma is going to give it to you. No amount of seeking is going to give it to you. Seeking. Sight. I'm looking for myself. I'm looking for myself. That's why he says, starts out with this nachakshusha grihyate. This isn't something gained by the eyes, so don't go looking for yourself. Don't do austerities for yourself. Don't do karmas to try to produce yourself. They say, uh-oh.
Now what?
So he says, jnana prasadena. There's a couple of different ways to take this. Jnana prasadena, by the grace of knowledge. Jnana is knowledge. Jnana prasadena, by the grace of knowledge. Vishuddha sattvaha, the one whose mind is pure. Tattaha, then, that person who is a Vishuddha sattvaha, who has the antakarana shuddhi, who has the purity of mind. For that person, by the grace of knowledge, we'll see that in a minute, the grace of knowledge, that person, jayamanaha, who is single-pointed. Jayamanaha means that they're reflecting on this, they're thinking about this, inquiring into this. That person, pashyate, pashyate is pashyati, same thing. That person sees tam, that, tamatmanam, that self which is nishkalam, which is free from any parts. Free from parts means free from duality. To be able to say, I am the whole. So, what is this? This is an amazing verse because he spent these last, the Upanishad has spent these last few verses talking about the antakarana shuddhi and using the term, antakarana shuddhi means purity of mind. Then uses vishuddha sattvaha, the one who has that antakarana shuddhi, that purity of mind. Where do you get that? Karmana? Through karma? You can get that, right? Through tapas, you can get that. Through satyam, speaking the truth, which is what they put so much emphasis on in this Upanishad. Through speaking the truth, satyam hitam priyam, let what you say be true, let it be beneficial, let it be pleasing. Through that discipline, ahimsa, non-injury, through these values, you can get the vishuddha sattva. Vishuddha sattva, what does it mean? It means that my mind has shanti, right? My mind has peace. What does peace mean? Peace means this. The average mind is involved in the world. I want this to be happy. 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 Okay, when I say that, did you notice that I'm only saying one thing at a time? I want this to be happy. I want this to... That's not it. It's because I can't say it 1,000 times at once. You know what I'm saying? It's not just, I want this to be happy, and I say it a whole bunch of times at once so that there's a network, right? And then, behind that, there are more subtle networks of I want this to be happy, and I need this to be happy, and I need this to be happy. And behind that, there's more subtle networks. That's the unconscious that has to be totally, you know, unwound. I need it to be like this. I need it to be like this. I need it to be like this. On multi dimensions, right? So that mind is not vishuddha sattva. That mind is engaged. It is engaged in the world, trying to make the world become what I need it to be so that now I can say, all is well with me. Or it doesn't stop there, you know. That's not even saying it enough. I need the world, which includes me, to be in a certain way. It's not just the world. The world has to be in a certain way towards me. Everyone has to love me and respect me. And? Okay. And think that I'm really great. You know, you should love me, respect me. Think that I'm really, really great. But that's not enough. I should love me and respect me and think that I'm really great also. Because if I don't love me and respect me and think that I'm really great, then even if you love me and respect me and think that I'm great, I won't believe you. Right? So it's very, very complex. It sounds so silly. But when you start looking at your problems, oh, it's I need to be loved, I need to be loved, I need to be loved, I need to be loved. And it's a multi-dimensional. And so now we have to be able to unwind all of this. You know, we need to be able to unwind all of it. And this whole, all of the sadhanas, dharma, ahimsa, satyam, telling the truth, all of these things, right? Karma yoga that we spent so much in the Bhagavad Gita, that prasada buddhi, that karma yoga buddhi, accepting everything as prasad from the Lord. All of these things are for, you know, for what? To unwind, to give this antikarana, to give my mind a chance to unwind so that it can sit silently, so that it can, now what do I mean sit silently? So that it can relax, so that it can relax and look inward in a sense. Now what do I mean by look inward? That's another problem. But if we look at it, normally this mind is totally engaged in the world, trying to create a loving environment where I can feel good about myself. So I'm engaged in the world, it's secure. Also, you know, there's other things. I want to feel good about myself, but I want to have a lot of money, you know, and a nice home. And I want to be able to put enough away so that I don't have to worry about it. I'm telling you, it's endless. Just think about all of the things that you really need, you know, to make it all work. Right? It's endless. Okay, so anyway. My mind needs to be able to have enough relaxation, right? Have enough relaxation through that prasada buddhi, taking everything as Ishwara, through kaushalam, understanding dharma, through satyam, through telling the truth so that my mind doesn't have to be juggling the situations all the time. So that level of honesty, all of these things we've discussed, I need that so my mind has enough peace to be able to recognize, to be able to focus on Shravana, Manana, Nididhyasana. It's in the Bhashyam, Swamiji writes about it too. For my mind to be able to use this primary sadhana of jnanam. Because look, this is the situation. The self that you are is the one that is whole and complete. The conscious being that you are is the one that is whole and complete. That conscious being is not away from your mind. It is the self of the mind. The very conscious being is the self of the mind. But the mind is, because of ignorance, is so enamored by the world that it itself is creating a sensation, a situation, a sensation of pain for itself, because it's trying to discover in the world this wholeness that already is my nature. And so what has to happen now is first the mind has to relax. Because if it relaxes, it already starts to experience that wholeness. Even without knowledge, it just simply needs to relax. It starts to experience the wholeness. As it experiences that wholeness, just because of its relaxation, then now it is in a condition to follow the implied meaning of the words that the Upanishads have to unfold to you. In other words, if I say to you, are you aware of your mind? It's a simple sentence. Are you aware of your mind? Right? Can you sit there and recognize the fact that this is not brain science? Can you recognize experientially the fact of it, that you are aware of your mind? That as the thoughts pass through, that those thoughts, each thought that passes through enjoys awareness. Each thought, it is known, it is known, it is known. Yes, I'm aware of my mind. I'm aware of every thought in the mind. Can you say that? If you can say that, that's a huge thing. You can just this, you can say, yes, every single thought that I have, I'm saying a little differently now, every single thought that I have takes place in awareness. There's no thought that's away from consciousness. You can say yes. If your mind is quiet enough, you can say, yeah, that's true. Every single thought that I have, there is no thought that is separate from, away from consciousness. Then say, if I ask you number two, Do the thoughts change? Absolutely. Mile a minute. Okay. Do the thoughts change? Yes. Do you continue to be aware of the thoughts as they change? Thought, thought, thought. Now, a lot of people will just immediately say yes. Of course, it's obvious. If our thoughts come and go and I remain aware of the thoughts. It's true, you say yes immediately because it's logically sound. Right? So your mind say, well, yes, if the thoughts, one thought comes, the next thought comes, the next thought comes, the next thought comes, and I remain. So that's just logically sound. But now, with this jnana prasada, now we want the mind to say, I want to say, all right, you see that. Now just relax for a minute. If you understand that logically, let yourself recognize the truth of it. If you say that the thoughts come and go and I remain, then you're talking about your own presence which remains. Now, that's a huge thing to recognize. If you can say, the thoughts come and go and I remain, and you know and you're able to identify the me that remains, then you've discovered the self which is changeless. Mm-hmm. See, we say these words, and the words make sense to us, and we know they're true. But now, since you know they're true, you need to let those words land on that truth, the truth of your own being. Because if they land on the truth of your own being, then what is your inner condition? Your inner condition then is, I am present as a changeless self in which all of these thoughts come and go. I am the changeless self in which all thoughts come and go. Is it true or not? Yes, it's true. Then what's the problem then? If I am the self in which all thoughts come and go, in which all change comes and goes, in which all moods comes and goes, do I come and go? No. Do I change? No. Am I always the same? Yes. Then what is the problem? So this is the start. This is really where it has to start. Now say you recognize, the mind recognizes, okay, because there is still a problem. 2 more minutes. The mind recognizes, right, that all right, my being, right, I don't come and go. My self doesn't come and go. Now the thing is, what is this self like that doesn't come and go? What is this me, this presence that doesn't come and go, that's always the same? Then, I'm trying to bring back these meditations to you. Is this presence desirable or not? Is your presence, the one that is always there, desirable or not? In fact, it's the one that all of the Upanishads and the Sufis, they all, even Christian mystics, will refer to as the beloved. What are they talking about? This one that doesn't come and go. So now, your task is to really take this seriously to see, is this me, this intimate me, that doesn't come and go, the beloved or not? Is it the beloved that the Sufis talk about, that the Hindu mystics talk about, that the Christian mystics talk about, that the Upanishads talk about? Is this me the beloved or not? That you need to discover that. If you say yes, wow, that's amazing. If you say yes, that this being, that is me, that is changelessly present to whatever thoughts are there, that this my nature is the beloved, and I don't come and go, then that's a wonderful thing. That's a wonderful thing because now the mind, is the mind ever away from the beloved? Is your mind ever away from the beloved? And if you said yes, then the mind would have to be away from the self. Is the mind ever away from consciousness? No. And so that means, in fact, the mind always has a home base. It is always, I'll put it this way, the mind is always home. It can never be away from home. And so now, what do you need to do? Well, it's actually not a matter of doing. It's not a matter of doing, but it's a matter of continuing to see that. Because the mind is so lifetimes of conditioning, of being dragged out through the mill of samsara and then beaten on the head in every conceivable way. Because the world is always changing. It's always eating you alive, actually. The time and change are eating you alive. And so the mind has been, you know, had a hard time of it. And so it's, you know, it has post-traumatic stress disorder. So we have to, you know, pull it back. You have to do a little dhyana, a little meditation, or just throughout the day. It's not that you have to sit and meditate for 10 hours a day, but you're always meditating. When are you not here? When are you not here? So it's always bringing your mind back to that obvious recognition, that thing that you actually do know. Now you have to start saying, wow, I really do know that. And then you have to say, well, what is it exactly that I know? Now, what I mean by that, say, if I say, is it true that you're aware of your mind? And the thoughts are coming and go. Yes, it's true. All right, well, let's break it apart then. There's the sat-chit, there's the conscious being that is not coming and going. There's me. I'm not coming and going. And then there's everything else that's coming and going. So who is this me? But now the mind has to differentiate that and sit, recognize that there's that constant presence. Then, is this me, the beloved, or not? Is it desirable? Yes or no? If it is, if you recognize that, then your mind should be so happy. So happy, because the one that it needs is the one who is there. The one that the mind needs is the one that is there. You don't have to go anywhere for it. That is moksha. Moksha because the self doesn't come and go. Okay? You are the self that doesn't come and go. No more maintenance man.
Good.
Okay, let's just take a moment. Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamadachate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishate Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.